This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. The Green Carnation was a scandalous book first published anonymously in 1894 by Robert Hitchens, whose lead characters are closely based on Oscar Wilde and Lord Alfred Douglas, whom the author knew personally. In the book, Wilde is represented by the character Esme Amarinth, and Douglas by the character Lord Reginald Hastings. Most of the words spoken by Amarinth and Hastings were gathered when Hitchens spent almost a year in the company of Oscar Wilde and Lord Alfred Douglas, thereby claiming to recreate the relationship between the two men. In 1895, the book was withdrawn from circulation, but it was too late to save Wilde. During that same time, Lord Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, who was deeply troubled by the relationship between his son and Wilde, sent a note to the Albemarle Club addressed to Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite. With Lord Alfred's encouragement, Wilde sued his father for libel. Bad decision. Not only did he lose the case, but he was sent to trial himself. He stood three consecutive trials for gross indecency and was sentenced to 2 years at hard labor in Reading Jail. According to Oscar Wilde's grandson, Merlin Holland, Lord Alfred Douglas visited Wilde daily while he was in custody, and after his conviction wrote a defense of their love for a French journal which would have done him more harm than good and was never published. Upon his release from prison on May 19, 1897, Wilde wrote the poem The Ballad of Reading Jail, probably because a prisoner whom Wilde had seen many times was hanged. The main theme of the poem is the death penalty. And although he never hid the fact that he wrote the poem, he initially published it under the name C.3.3 as a way of indicating Building C, Floor 3, Cell 3 at Reading. There are passages of the poem that have become quite familiar. Here is one. Yet each man kills the thing he loves. By each let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Up next, I'll play Noel Coward performing Green Carnations, followed by Wilde's poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail.
Pretty boys, witty boys, too, 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 lazy to fight stagnation. Haughty boys, naughty boys, all we do is to pursue sensation. The portals of society are always opened wide, the world our eccentricity condones. A note of quaint variety we're certain to provide, we dress in very decorative tones. Faded boys, jaded boys, womankind's gift to a bulldog nation. In order to distinguish us from less enlightened minds, we all wear a green carnation.
The Ballad of Reading Jail by Oscar Wilde. He did not wear his scarlet coat, for blood and wine are red. And blood and wine were on his hands when they found him with the dead. The poor dead woman whom he loved and murdered in her bed. He walked amongst the trial men in a suit of shabby gray. A cricket cap was on his head, and his step seemed light and gay. But I never saw a man who looked so wistfully at the day. I never saw a man who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue which prisoners call the sky, and at every drifting cloud that went with sails of silver by. I walked with other souls in pain within another ring, and was wondering if the man had done a great or little thing, when a voice behind me whispered low, "That fellow's got to swing." Dear Christ, the very prison walls suddenly seemed to reel, and the sky above my head became like a cask of scorching steel, and though I was a soul in pain, my pain I could not feel. I only knew what hunted thought quickened his step, and why he looked upon the garish day with such a wistful eye. The man had killed the thing he loved, and so he had to die. Yet each man kills the thing he loves. By each let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Some kill their love when they are young, and some when they are old. Some strangle with the hands of lust, some with the hands of gold. The kindest use a knife, because the dead so soon grow cold. Some love too little, some too long, some sell and others buy. Some do the deed with many tears, and some without a sigh. For each man kills the thing he loves, yet each man does not die. He does not die a death of shame on a day of dark disgrace, nor have a noose about his neck, nor a cloth upon his face, nor drop feet foremost through the floor into an empty space. He does not sit with silent men who watch him night and day, who watch him when he tries to weep and when he tries to pray, who watch him lest himself should rob the prison of its prey. He does not wake at dawn to see dread figures throng his room, the shivering chaplain robed in white, the sheriff stern with gloom, and the governor all in shiny black with the yellow face of doom. He does not rise in piteous haste to put on convict clothes, while some coarse-mouthed doctor gloats and notes each new and nerve-twitched pose, figuring a watch whose little ticks are horrible hammer blows. He does not know that sickening thirst that sands one's throat before the hangman with his gardener's glove slips through the padded door and binds one with three leathern thongs that the throat may thirst no more. He does not bend his head to hear the burial office read, nor while the terror of his soul tells him he is not dead, cross his own coffin as he moves into the hideous shed. He does not stare upon the air through a little roof of glass. He does not pray with lips of clay for his agony to pass, nor feel upon his shuddering cheek that kiss of Caiaphas. 2. 6 weeks our guardsman walked the yard in the suit of shabby gray. His cricket cap was on his head, and his step seemed light and gay. But I never saw a man who looked so wistfully at the day. I never saw a man who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue which prisoners call the sky, and at every wandering cloud that trailed its raveled fleeces by. He did not wring his hands as do those witless men who dare to try to rear the changeling hope in the cave of black despair. He only looked upon the sun and drank the morning air. He did not wring his hands nor weep, nor did he peak or pine, but he drank the air as though it held some healthful anodyne. With open mouth he drank the sun as though it had been wine. And I and all the souls in pain who tramped the other ring forgot if we ourselves had done a great or little thing, and watched with gaze of dull amaze the man who had to swing. And strange it was to see him pass with a step so light and gay, and strange it was to see him look so wistfully at the day, and strange it was to think that he had such a debt to pay. For oak and elm have pleasant leaves that in the springtime shoot, but grim to see is the gallows tree with its adder-bitten root, and green or dry a man must die before it bears its fruit. The loftiest place is that seat of grace for which all worldlings try. But who would stand in hempen band upon a scaffold high and through a murderer's collar take his last look at the sky? It is sweet to dance to violins when love and life are fair. To dance to flutes, to dance to lutes is delicate and rare. But it is not sweet with nimble feet to dance upon the air. So with curious eyes and sick surmise, we watched him day by day, and wondered if each one of us would end the self-same way, for none can tell to what red hell his sightless soul may stray. At last the dead man walked no more amongst the trial men, and I knew that he was standing up in the black dock's dreadful pen, and that never would I see his face in God's sweet world again. Like two doomed ships that pass in storm, we had crossed each other's way. But we made no sign, we said no word, we had no word to say. For we did not meet in the holy night, but in the shameful day. A prison wall was round us both, two outcast men we were. The world had thrust us from its heart, and God from out his care. And the iron gin that waits for sin had caught us in its snare. 3. In debtor's yard the stones are hard, and the dripping wall is high. So it was there he took the air beneath the leaden sky, and by each side a warder walked, for fear the man might die. Or else he sat with those who watched his anguish night and day, who watched him when he rose to weep, and when he crouched to pray, who watched him lest himself should rob their scaffold of its prey. The governor was strong upon the Regulations Act. The doctor said that death was but a scientific fact, and twice a day the chaplain called and left a little tract. And twice a day he smoked his pipe and drank his quart of beer. His soul was resolute and held no hiding place for fear. He often said that he was glad the hangman's hands were near. But why he said so strange a thing, no warder dared to ask. For he to whom a watcher's doom is given as his task must set a lock upon his lips and make his face a mask. Or else he might be moved and try to comfort or console. And what should human pity do pent up in murderer's hole? What word of grace in such a place could help a brother's soul? With slouch and swing around the ring we trod the fool's parade. We did not care, we knew we were the devil's own brigade, and shaven head and feet of lead made a merry masquerade. We tore the tarry rope to shreds with blunt and bleeding nails. We rubbed the doors and scrubbed the floors and cleaned the shining rails, and rank by rank we soaped the plank and clattered with the pails. We sewed the sacks, we broke the stones, we turned the dusty drill. We banged the tins and bawled the hymns and sweated on the mill. But in the heart of every man, terror was lying still. So still it lay that every day crawled like a weed-clogged wave, and we forgot the bitter lot that waits for fool and knave, till once, as we tramped in from work, we passed an open grave. With yawning mouth the yellow hole gaped for a living thing. The very mud cried out for blood to the thirsty asphalt ring, and we knew that ere one dawn grew fair, some prisoner had to swing. Right in we went with soul intent on death and dread and doom. The hangman with his little bag went shuffling through the gloom, and each man trembled as he crept into his numbered tomb. That night the empty corridors were full of forms of fear, and up and down the iron town stole feet we could not hear, and through the bars that hide the stars white faces seemed to peer. He lay as one who lies and dreams in a pleasant meadowland. The watchers watched him as he slept, and could not understand how one could sleep so sweet a sleep with a hangman close at hand. But there is no sleep when men must weep who never yet have wept. So we, the fool, the fraud, the knave, that endless vigil kept, and through each brain on hands of pain another's terror crept. Alas, it is a fearful thing to feel another's guilt, for right within the sword of sin pierced to its poisoned hilt, and as molten lead were the tears we shed for the blood we had not spilt. The warders with their shoes of felt crept by each padlocked door, and peeped and saw with eyes of awe gray figures on the floor, and wondered why men knelt to pray who never prayed before. All through the night we knelt and prayed, mad mourners of a corse. The troubled plumes of midnight were the plumes upon a hearse, and bitter wine upon a sponge was the savor of remorse. The gray cock crew, the red cock crew, but never came the day, and crooked shapes of terror crouched in the corners where we lay, and each evil sprite that walks by night before us seemed to play. They glided past, they glided fast, like travelers through a mist, They mocked the moon in a rigadoon of delicate turn and twist, and with formal pace and loathsome grace the phantoms kept their tryst. With mop and mow we saw them go, slim shadows hand in hand. About, about, in ghostly rout, they trod a saraband, and the damned grotesques made arabesques like the wind upon the sand. With pirouettes of marionettes they tripped on pointed tread, but with flutes of fear they filled the ear as their grisly mask they led. And loud they sang and long they sang, for they sang to wake the dead. "Oh-ho!" they cried, "the world is wide, but fettered limbs go lame, and once or twice to throw the dice is a gentlemanly game, but he does not win who plays with sin in the secret house of shame." No things of air these antics were that frolicked with such glee to men whose lives were held in gyves and whose feet might not go free. Oh, wounds of Christ, they were living things most terrible to see. Around, around, they waltzed and wound, some wheeled in smirking pairs. With the mincing step of a demirep, some sidled up the stairs, and with subtle sneer and fawning leer, each helped us at our prayers. The morning wind began to moan, but still the night went on. Through its giant loom the web of gloom crept till each thread was spun, and as we prayed, we grew afraid of the justice of the sun. The moaning wind went wandering round the weeping prison wall, till like a wheel of turning steel we felt the minutes crawl. O moaning wind, what had we done to have such a seneschal? At last I saw the shadowed bars, like a lattice wrought in lead, move right across the whitewashed wall that faced my three-planked bed, and I knew that somewhere in the world God's dreadful dawn was red. At 6 o'clock we cleaned our cells. At 7 all was still, but the sough and swing of a mighty wing the prison seemed to fill, for the Lord of Death, with icy breath, had entered in to kill. He did not pass in purple pomp, nor ride a moon-white steed. 3 yards of cord and a sliding board are all the gallows need. So with rope of shame the herald came to do the secret deed. We were as men who through a fen of filthy darkness grope. We did not dare to breathe a prayer or to give our anguish scope. Something was dead in each of us, and what was dead was hope. For man's grim justice goes its way and will not swerve aside. It slays the weak, it slays the strong, it has a deadly stride. With iron heel it slays the strong, the monstrous parasite. We waited for the stroke of 8. Each tongue was thick with thirst. For the stroke of 8 is the stroke of fate that makes a man accursed. And fate will use a running noose for the best man and the worst. We had no other thing to do save to wait for the sign to come. So like things of stone in a valley lone, quiet we sat, and dumb. But each man's heart beat thick and quick, like a madman on a drum. With sudden shock the prison clock smote on the shivering air, and from all the jail rose up a wail of impotent despair, like the sound that frightened marshes hear from some leper in his lair. And as one sees most dreadful things in the crystal of a dream, we saw the greasy hempen rope hooked to the blackened beam, and heard the prayer the hangman's snare strangled into a scream. And all the woe that moved him so that he gave that bitter cry, and the wild regrets and the bloody sweats, none knew so well as I. For he who lives more lives than one, more deaths than one must die. 4. There is no chapel on the day on which they hang a man. The chaplain's heart is far too sick, or his face is far too wan, or there is that written in his eyes which none should look upon. So they kept us close till nigh on noon, and then they rang the bell, and the warders with their jingling keys opened each listening cell, and down the iron stair we tramped, each from his separate hell. Out into God's sweet air we went, but not in wonted way, for this man's face was white with fear, and that man's face was gray, and I never saw sad men who looked so wistfully at the day. I never saw sad men who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue we prisoners call the sky, and at every careless cloud that passed in happy freedom by. But there were those amongst us all who walked with downcast head, and knew that, had each got his due, they should have died instead. He had but killed a thing that lived, whilst they had killed the dead. For he who sins a second time wakes a dead soul to pain, and draws it from its spotted shroud, and makes it bleed again, and makes it bleed great gouts of blood, and makes it bleed in vain. Like ape or clown in monstrous garb, with crooked arrows starred, silently we went round and round the slippery asphalt yard. Silently we went round and round, and no man spoke a word. Silently we went round and round, and through each hollow mind the memory of dreadful things rushed like a dreadful wind, and honor stalked before each man, and terror crept behind. The warders strutted up and down, and kept their herd of brutes. Their uniforms were spick and span, they wore their Sunday suits. But we knew the work they had been at by the quicklime on their boots. For where a grave had opened wide, there was no grave at all, only a stretch of mud and sand by the hideous prison wall, and a little heap of burning lime that the man should have his pall. For he has a pall, this wretched man, such as few men can claim. Deep down below a prison yard, naked for greater shame, he lies with fetters on each foot, wrapped in a sheet of flame. And all the while the burning lime eats flesh and bone away. It eats the brittle bone by night and the soft flesh by day. It eats the flesh and bone by turns, but it eats the heart away. For 3 long years they will not sow or root or seedling there. For 3 long years the unblessed spot will sterile be and bare, and look upon the wondering sky with unreproachful stare. They think a murderer's heart would taint each simple seed they sow. It is not true. God's kindly earth is kindlier than men know, and the red rose would but blow more red, and the white rose whiter blow. Out of his mouth a red, red rose, out of his heart a white. For who can say by what strange way Christ brings his will to light, since the barren staff the pilgrim bore bloomed in the great Pope's sight? But neither milk-white rose nor red may bloom in prison air. The shard, the pebble, and the flint are what they give us there, for flowers have been known to heal a common man's despair. So never will wine red rose or white petal by petal fall on that stretch of mud and sand that lies by that hideous prison wall, to tell the men who tramp the yard that God's Son died for all. Yet though the hideous prison wall still hems him round and round, and a spirit may not walk by night that is with fetters bound, and a spirit may but weep that lies in such unholy ground, he is at peace, this wretched man, at peace, or will be soon. There is no thing to make him mad, nor does terror walk at noon, for the lampless earth in which he lies has neither sun nor moon. They hanged him as a beast is hanged. They did not even toll a requiem that might have brought rest to his startled soul, but hurriedly they took him out and hid him in a hole. They stripped him of his canvas clothes and gave him to the flies. They mocked the swollen purple throat and the stark and staring eyes, and with laughter loud they heaped the shroud in which their convict lies. The chaplain would not kneel to pray by his dishonored grave, nor mark it with that blessed cross the Christ for sinners gave, because the man was one of those whom Christ came down to save. Yet all is well, he is but passed to life's appointed bourn, and alien tears will fill for him pity's long-broken urn, for his mourners will be outcast men, and outcasts always mourn. 5. I know not whether laws be right, or whether laws be wrong. All that we know who lie in jail is that the wall is strong, and that each day is like a year whose days are long. But this I know, that every law that men have made for man, since first man took his brother's life, and this sad world began, but straws the wheat and saves the chaff with a most evil fan. This too I know, and wise it were if I could know the same, that every prison that men build is built with bricks of shame, and bound with bars lest Christ should see how men their brothers maim. With bars they blur the gracious moon and blind the goodly sun, and they do well to hide their hell, for in it things are done that son of God nor son of man ever should look upon. The vilest deeds, like poison weeds, bloom well in prison air. It is only what is good in man that wastes and withers there. Pale anguish keeps the heavy gate, and the warder is despair. For they starve the little frightened child till it weeps both night and day, and they scourge the weak and flog the fool and gibe the old and gray. And some grow mad and all grow bad, and none a word may say. Each narrow cell in which we dwell is a foul and dark latrine, and the fetid breath of living death chokes up each grated screen, and all but lust is turned to dust in humanity's machine. The brackish water that we drink creeps with a loathsome slime, and the bitter bread they weigh in scales is full of chalk and lime, and sleep will not lie down, but walks wild-eyed and cries to time. But though lean hunger and green thirst, like asp with adder fight, we have little care of prison fare, for what chills and kills outright is that every stone one lifts by day becomes one's heart by night. With midnight always in one's heart and twilight in one's cell, we turn the crank or tear the rope, each in his separate hell, and the silence is more awful far than the sound of a brazen bell. And never a human voice comes near to speak a gentle word, and the eye that watches through the door is pitiless and hard, and by all forgot we rot and rot with soul and body marred. And thus we rust life's iron chain, degraded and alone, and some men curse and some men weep, and some men make no moan. But God's eternal laws are kind and break the heart of stone. And every human heart that breaks in prison cell or yard is as that broken box that gave its treasure to the Lord and filled the unclean leper's house with the scent of costliest nard. Ah, happy are those whose hearts can break and peace of pardon win. How else may man make straight his plan and cleanse his soul from sin? How else but through a broken heart may Lord Christ enter in? And he of the swollen purple throat and the stark and staring eyes waits for the holy hands that took the thief to paradise, and a broken and contrite heart the Lord will not despise. The man in red who reads the law gave him 3 weeks of life, 3 little weeks in which to heal his soul of his soul's strife, and cleanse from every blot of blood the hand that held the knife. And with tears of blood he cleansed the hand that held the steel, for only blood can wipe out blood, and only tears can heal. And the crimson stain, that was of Cain, became Christ's snow-white seal. 6. In Reading Jail by Reading Town there is a pit of shame. and in it lies a wretched man, eaten by teeth of flame. In a burning winding sheet he lies, and his grave has got no name. And there, till Christ call forth the dead, in silence let him lie. No need to waste the foolish tear or heave the windy sigh. The man had killed the thing he loved, and so he had to die. And all men kill the thing they love, by all let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Oscar Wilde's poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail. Up next, Frank McCourt, author of Angela's Ashes, reads the short story Two Sisters from James Joyce's Dubliners. First, one more piece of music. Here's Al Boley singing The Man I Love.
When the mellow moon begins to beam, every night I dream a little dream, and of course Prince Charming is the theme, but he for me, although I realize as well as you, it is seldom that a dream comes true. To me it's clear that he'll appear. Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and smile, I'll understand, and in a little while, he'll take my hand, and though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say a word. Maybe I shall meet him someday, maybe Monday, maybe not. Still, I'm sure to meet him one day, maybe Tuesday will be my good new day. He'll build a little home just meant for two, from which I'll never roam. Who would you? And so all else above, I'm waiting for the man I love. Someday he'll come along, the man I love, and he'll be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and smile, I'll understand, and in a little while, he'll take my hand. And though it seems absurd, I know we both won't say a word. Maybe I shall meet him someday, maybe Monday, maybe not. Still, I'm sure to meet him one day. Maybe Tuesday will be my good news day. He'll build a little home just meant for two, from which I'll never roam. Who would you? And so all else above, I'm waiting for the man I love.
This is Catherine Hastings. In the summer of 1904, a member of the Irish Homestead's editorial department sent James Joyce a letter that read in part, "Dear Joyce, look at the story in this paper. Could you write anything simple, rural, live-making, pathos, which could be inserted so as not to shock the readers? If you could furnish a short story about 1,800 words suitable for insertion, the editor will pay. It is easily earned money if you can write fluently and don't mind playing to the common understanding and liking for once in a way. You can sign it any name you like as a pseudonym." Joyce responded favorably to the offer and published what would later become the first short story in The Dubliners, The Sisters. When published in The Irish Homestead, and it was his first published work of fiction, Joyce used the pseudonym Stephen Dedalus, a name given to one of his semi-autobiographical characters in his novels A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses. The Sisters, which is narrated by a nameless boy enthralled with interpreting signs and symbols and their meaning, gives a portrait of the relationship between that boy and his mentor, the infirmed priest, Father Flynn. The priest has two sisters, Eliza and Nanny. Other characters who appear in the story include Old Cotter and the nameless aunt and uncle of the boy. Here now is Frank McCourt, author of Angela's Ashes, reading The Sisters by James Joyce.
There was no hope for him this time. It was the third stroke. Night after night I had passed the house, it was vacation time, and studied the lighted square of window. And night after night I had found it lighted in the same way, faintly and evenly. If he was dead, I thought, I would see the reflection of candles on the darkened blind, for I knew that two candles must be set at the head of a corpse. He had often said to me, "I am not long for this world." And I had thought his words idle. Now I knew they were true. Every night, as I gazed up at the window, I said softly to myself the word paralysis. It had always sounded strangely in my ears like the word gnomon in the Euclid and the word simony in the Catechism, but now it sounded to me like the name of some maleficent and sinful being. It filled me with fear, and yet I longed to be nearer to it and to look upon its deadly work. Old Cotter was sitting at the fire smoking when I came downstairs to supper. While my aunt was ladling out my stirabout, he said, as if returning to some former remark of his,
"No, I wouldn't say he was exactly... But there was something queer, there was something uncanny about him. I'll tell you my opinion." He began to puff at his pipe, no doubt arranging his opinion in his mind. Tiresome old fool. When we knew him first, he used to be rather interesting, talking of faints and worms. But I soon grew tired of him and his endless stories about the distillery.
"I have my own theory about it," he said. "I think it was one of those peculiar cases, but it's hard to say."
He began to puff again at his pipe without giving us his theory. My uncle saw me staring and said to me,
"Well, so your old friend is gone, you'll be sorry to hear."
"Who?" said I.
"Father Flynn. Is he dead?"
"Mr. Cotter here has just told us. He was passing by the house." I knew that I was under observation, so I continued eating, as if the news had not interested me. My uncle explained to old Cotter. The youngster and he were great friends. The old chap taught him a great deal, mind you, and they say he had a great wish for him.
"God have mercy on his soul," said my aunt piously.
Old Cotter looked at me for a while. I felt that his little beady black eyes were examining me, but I would not satisfy him by looking up from my plate. He returned to his pipe and finally spat rudely into the grate.
"I wouldn't like children of mine," he said, "to have too much to say to a man like that."
"How do you mean, Mr. Cotter?" asked my aunt.
"What I mean is," said old Cotter, "it's bad for children. My idea is, let a young lad run about and play with young lads of his own age and not be... Am I right, Jack?"
"That's my principle too," said my uncle. "Let him learn to box his corner. That's what I'm always saying to that Rosicrucian there. Take exercise. Why, when I was a nipper, every morning of my life I had a cold bath, winter and summer, and that's what stands to me now. Education is all very fine and large. Mr. Cotter might take a pick of that leg of mutton," he added to my aunt.
"No, no, not for me," said old Cotter.
My aunt brought the dish from the safe and laid it on the table.
"But why do you think it's not good for children, Mr. Cotter?" she asked.
"It's bad for children," said old Cotter, "because their minds are so impressionable. When children see things like that, you know, it has an effect." I crammed my mouth with stirabout for fear I might give utterance to my anger. Tiresome old red-nosed imbecile. It was late when I fell asleep. Though I was angry with old Carter for alluding to me as a child, I puzzled my head to extract meaning from his unfinished sentences. In the dark of my room, I imagined I saw again the heavy, grey face of the paralytic. I drew the blankets over my head and tried to think of Christmas, but the grey face still followed me. It murmured, and I understood that it desired to confess something. I felt my soul receding into some pleasant and vicious region, and there again I found it waiting for me. It began to confess to me in a murmuring voice, and I wondered why it smiled continually, and why the lips were so moist with spittle. But then I remembered that it had died of paralysis, and I felt that I too was smiling feebly, as if to absorb the simoniac of his sin. The next morning after breakfast, I went down to look at the little house in Great Britain Street. It was an unassuming shop, registered under the vague name of Drapery. The drapery consisted mainly of children's booties and umbrellas, and on ordinary days a notice used to hang in the window saying, "Umbrellas recovered." No notice was visible now, for the shutters were up. A crepe bouquet was tied to the door knocker with ribbon. Two poor women and a telegram boy were reading the card pinned on the crepe. I also approached and read, July 1st, 1895. The Reverend James Flynn, formerly of St. Catherine's Church, Meath Street, aged 65 years, R.I.P. The reading of the card persuaded me that he was dead, and I was disturbed to find myself at check. Had he not been dead, I would have gone into the little dark room behind the shop to find him sitting in his armchair by the fire, nearly smothered in his greatcoat. Perhaps my aunt would have given me a packet of high toast for him, and this present would have roused him from his stupefied doze. It was always I who emptied the packet into his black snuff-box, for his hands trembled too much to allow him to do this without spilling half the snuff about the floor. Even as he raised his large trembling hand to his nose, little clouds of smoke dribbled through his fingers over the front of his coat. It may have been these constant showers of snuff which gave his ancient priestly garments their green, faded look, for the red handkerchief, blackened as it always was with the snuff stains of a week, with which he tried to brush away the fallen grains, was quite inefficacious. I wished to go in and look at him, but I had not the courage to knock. I walked away slowly along the sunny side of the street, reading all the theatrical advertisements in the shop windows as I went. I found it strange that neither I nor the day seemed in a mourning mood, and I felt even annoyed at discovering in myself a sensation of freedom, as if I'd been freed from something by his death. I wondered at this, for as my uncle had said the night before, he had taught me a great deal. He had studied in the Irish College in Rome, and he had taught me to pronounce Latin properly. He had told me stories about the catacombs and about Napoleon Bonaparte, and he had explained to me the meaning of the different ceremonies of the Mass and of the different vestments worn by the priest. Sometimes he had amused himself by putting difficult questions to me, asking me what one should do in certain circumstances, or whether such and such sins were mortal or venial, are only imperfections. His question showed me how complex and mysterious were certain institutions of the Church, which I had always regarded as the simplest acts. The duties of the priest towards the Eucharist and towards the secrecy of the confessional seemed so grave to me that I wondered how anybody had ever found in himself the courage to undertake them. And I was not surprised when he told me that the fathers of the Church had written books as thick as the post office directory and as closely printed as the law notices in the newspaper, elucidating all these intricate questions. Often when I thought of this, I could make no answer, or only a very foolish and halting one, upon which he used to smile and nod his head twice or thrice. Sometimes he used to put me through the responses of the Mass, which he had made me learn by heart. And as I pattered, he used to smile pensively and nod his head, now and then pushing huge pinches of snuff up each nostril alternately. When he smiled, he used to uncover his big discolored teeth and let his tongue lie upon his lower lip, a habit which had made me feel uneasy in the beginning of our acquaintance, before I knew him well. As I walked along in the sun, I remembered old Carter's words and tried to remember what had happened afterwards in the dream. I remember that I'd noticed long velvet curtains and a swinging lamp of antique fashion. I felt that I'd been very far away in some land where the customs were strange, in Persia, I thought. But I could not remember the end of the dream. In the evening, my aunt took me with her to visit the house of mourning. It was after sunset, but the window panes of the houses that looked to the west reflected the tawny gold of a great bank of clouds. Nanny received us in the hall, and, as it would have been unseemly to have shouted at her, my aunt shook hands with her for all. The old woman pointed upwards interrogatively, and on my aunt's nodding, proceeded to toil up the narrow staircase before us, her bowed head being scarcely above the level of the banister rail. At the first landing she stopped and beckoned us forward encouragingly towards the open door of the dead room. My aunt went in, and the old woman, seeing that I hesitated to enter, began to beckon to me again, repeatedly, with her hand. I went down on tiptoe. The room, through the lace end of the blind, was suffused with dusky golden light, amid which the candles looked like pale, thin flames. He had been coffined. Nanny gave the lead, and we three knelt down at the foot of the bed. I pretended to pray, but I could not gather my thoughts because the old woman's mutterings distracted me. I noticed how clumsily her skirt was hooked at the back and how the heels of her cloth boots were trodden down all to one side. The fancy came to me that the old priest was smiling as he lay there in his coffin. But no. When we rose and went up to the head of the bed, I saw that he was not smiling. There he lay, solemn and copious, vested as for the altar, his large hands loosely retaining a chalice. His face was very truculent, grey and massive, with black cavernous nostrils and circled by a scanty white fur. There was a heavy odour in the room, the flowers. We blessed ourselves and came away. In the little room downstairs, we found Eliza seated in his armchair, in state. I groped my way towards my usual chair in the corner while Nanny went to the sideboard and brought out a decanter of sherry and some wine glasses. She set these on the table and invited us to take a little glass of wine. Then, at her sister's bidding, she poured out the sherry into the glasses and passed them to us. She pressed me to take some cream crackers also, but I declined because I thought I would make too much noise eating them. She seemed to be somewhat disappointed at my refusal and went over quietly to the sofa, where she sat down behind her sister. No one spoke. We all gazed at the empty fireplace. My aunt waited until Eliza sighed and then said, "Ah, well, he's gone to a better world." Eliza sighed again and bowed her head in assent. My aunt fingered the stem of her wine glass before sipping a little. "Did he? Peacefully?" she asked. "Oh, quite peacefully, ma'am," said Eliza. "You couldn't tell when the breath went out of him. He had a beautiful death, God be praised." "And everything?" "Father O'Rourke was in with him a Tuesday, and anointed him and prepared him and all." "He knew then?" "He was quite resigned." "He looks quite resigned," said my aunt. "That's what the woman we had in to wash him said. She said he just looked as if he was asleep. He looked that peaceful and resigned. No one would think he'd make such a beautiful corpse." "Yes, indeed," said my aunt. She sipped a little more from her glass and said, "Well, Miss Flynn, at any rate, it must be a great comfort for you to know that you did all you could for him. You were both very kind to him, I must say." Eliza smoothed her dress over her knees. "Ah, poor James," she said. "God knows we done all we could, as poor as we were. We wouldn't see him want anything while he was in it." Nanny had leaned her head against the sofa pillar and seemed about to fall asleep. "There's poor Nanny," said Eliza, looking at her. "She's wore out." All the work we had, she and me, getting in the woman to wash him, and then laying him out, and then the coffin, and then arranging about the mass in the chapel. Only for Father O'Rourke, I don't know what we'd have done at all. It was him brought us all them flowers and them two candlesticks out of the chapel, and wrote out the notice for the Freeman's General, and took charge of all the papers for the cemetery, and poor James's insurance. Wasn't that good of him, said my aunt. Eliza closed her eyes and shook her head slowly. Ah, there's no friends like the old friends, she said, when all is said and done. No friends that a body can trust. Indeed, that's true, said my aunt. And I'm sure now that he's gone to his eternal reward, he won't forget you and all your kindness to him. Ah, poor James, said Eliza. He was no great trouble to us. You wouldn't hear him in the house any more than now. Still, I know he's gone and all that. It's when it's all over that you'll miss him, said my aunt. I know that, said Eliza. I won't be bringing him in his cup of beef tea any more, nor you, ma'am, sending him his snuff. Ah, poor James. She stopped, as if she were communing with the past, and then said shrewdly, mind you, I noticed there was something queer coming over him latterly. Whenever I bring in his soup to him, there I'd find him with his breviary fallen on the floor, lying back in the chair, and his mouth open. She laid a finger against her nose and frowned. Then she continued. But still and all, he kept on saying that before the summer was over, he'd go out for a drive one fine day, just to see the old house again where we were all born down in Irish Town, and take me and Nanny with him. If we could only get one of them newfangled carriages that makes no noise, that Father O'Rourke told him about, them with the rheumatic wheels, for the day, cheap, he said, at Johnny Rush's over the way there, and drive out the three of us together of a Sunday evening. He had his mind set on that. Poor James. The Lord have mercy on his soul, said my aunt. Eliza took out her handkerchief and wiped her eyes with it. Then she put it back again in her pocket and gazed into the empty grate for some time without speaking. He was too scrupulous always, she said. The duties of the priesthood was too much for him. And then his life was, you might say, crossed. Yes, said my aunt. He was a disappointed man. You could see that. A silence took possession of the little room, and under cover of it, I approached the table and tasted my sherry, and then returned quietly to my chair in the corner. Eliza seemed to have fallen into a deep reverie. We waited respectfully for her to break the silence, and after a long pause she said slowly, "It was that chalice he broke. That was what was the beginning of it. Of course they say it was all right, that it contained nothing, I mean, but still, they say it was the boy's fault, but poor James was so nervous, God be merciful to him." "And was that it?" said my aunt. "I heard something." Eliza nodded. "That affected his mind," she said. "After that he began to mope by himself, talking to no one, and wandering about by himself. So one night he was wanted for to go on a call, and they couldn't find him anywhere. They looked high up and low down, and still they couldn't see a sight of him anywhere. So then the clerk suggested to try the chapel. So then they got the keys and opened the chapel, and the clerk and Father O'Rourke and another priest that was there brought in a light for to look for him. And what do you think but there he was, sitting up by himself in the dark in his confession box, wide awake and laughing like, softly to himself." She stopped suddenly, as if to listen. I too listened, but there was no sound in the house, and I knew that the old priest was lying still in his coffin, as we had seen him, solemn and truculent in death, an idle chalice on his breast. Eliza resumed, wide awake and laughing like to himself. So then, of course, when they saw that, that made them think that there was something gone wrong with him.
Over in Killarney, many years ago, my mother sang a song to me in tones so sweet and low. Just a simple little ditty in her good old Irish way. And I'd give the world if she could sing that song to me this day. I've wandered to my home again. I feel her arms a-hugging me as when she held me then. And I hear her voice a-humming to me as in days of yore, when she used to rock me fast asleep outside our cabin door.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's program featured Oscar Wilde's poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail, written after spending 2 years in prison for homosexual activity, and the short story, The Sisters, by James Joyce, read by Frank McCourt. The music you just heard was an Irish lullaby performed by the Irish tenor Frank Patterson, along with Ellie O'Grady on harp. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, please get in touch with me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.